Feeling stuck by a tough life decision? Wondering how to navigate career and leadership changes without chaos? Welcome to Problem Solved, the podcast where we cut through the confusion and turn uncertainty into action. I'm your host, Cheryl Strauss Einhorn, and I'm here to empower you with a powerful tool, the AREA method. Forget overwhelm, forget endless Googling, get ready to make confident, well-researched decisions that take charge of your life. Whether it's finding the perfect college, the ideal career path, or the best care for your loved ones. This isn't just about theory. Here we'll tackle real-world scenarios, dive into inspiring stories, and equip you with actionable steps. So buckle up, listeners, because it's time to say goodbye to indecision and hello to solutions. Today, we're thrilled to have with us a number one leader at a $2 billion executive search firm for over 14 years before becoming a top-rated global keynote speaker. She writes a popular column for Inc. magazine and is frequently tapped by top media like Forbes. She's a Success magazine woman of influence and a Glassdoor work-life pro, a LinkedIn learning instructor, and she's also an incurable chocoholic. She's a two-time TEDx speaker, and her book, Good Awkward, has won 18 awards and was endorsed by NFL quarterback Russell Wilson and former HBR editor Karen Dillon. Please give a big, warm welcome to Hannah Pryor. I'm so thrilled to welcome you, Hannah, to the show today. We always start off with the same question. Why is problem solving important?
I love this question. And my take on this is because today's normal is tomorrow's obsolete. Things are changing so fast that today, good problem solving, it's keeping us sharp. It keeps us adaptable. And more than anything, it keeps us ahead of disruption. Disruption is not going away. So problem solving today is agility training for our mind, and we need it more than ever.
Agility training for our mind. That is wonderful. And how do you think about a good decision? What constitutes a good decision?
This is one of those lessons that I've had to learn over and over again, because I could previously suffer from analysis paralysis over, did I make a good decision? Did I make a right decision? My personal take now is a, you know, quote unquote, good decision isn't about being right. It's about being brave enough to commit, to pivot or switch direction if necessary, and being wise enough to learn from something regardless of the outcome. So a good decision is really a good enough decision, loosely held. That to me constitutes a good decision now.
Good enough, loosely held. Tell us a little bit about your book and how awkwardness factors into decision making.
So awkwardness signals growth. Awkwardness is a social emotion that we tend to experience in front of other people. You know, if we make a mistake, if we blunder, if we mispronounce someone's name and we do it all by ourselves, we don't tend to feel awkward in those moments. It happens in front of others. Often when we work in teams with clients and any sort of, you know, social structure, we are going to feel that social discomfort at some point or another. So that discomfort in particular is nudging us towards these necessary conversations or these overlooked perspectives. So leaning into awkwardness, especially right now with the rate of change, especially with, you know, disruption and technology and five generations in the workforce, leaning into awkwardness is ultimately helping us lean into better decisions because we get pushed towards those necessary conversations and those other perspectives.
So interesting. So tell us a little bit more, though, about your book, how you came to be an expert in this topic, and that way you can share a little bit more of your journey with our listeners.
Yeah, the book is called Good Awkward, and really it was born from two major things. Number one is my life lived experience. So I was first born of immigrant parents, you know, first born in America, and I felt awkward my whole life. My whole childhood, I felt like my clothes were different, my way of speaking was different, the lunch in my lunchbox was different, and every part of my lived experience was a story of me wanting to blend in and instead feeling like I was sticking out. my bumpy edges were constantly on display. And I realized as I navigated through adulthood, you know, I found some confidence in college, you know, got a little bit more confident as I got older. But what I realized is that at every inflection point, every time I was in transition or things were changing, so new school, new job, new promotion in a new job, new boss, new team, all of those familiar feelings of awkwardness came bubbling back. So then part two of this was, you know, our queen, Brené Brown, who many of us in the professional development world love, she would use this expression. She would say, stay awkward, brave, and kind. That became a tagline of hers. And I remember hearing that thinking, okay, brave, yes, kind, uh-huh, I agree, but awkward, like, this lady, does she know? Does she know how difficult it is to navigate the world when that feeling has its grip in you? And so it made me get very curious about the role of this particular emotion in our decision-making, in our problem-solving, in our team dynamics, in the risks we're willing to take, in the conversations we're willing or unwilling to have. And I realized that nobody had done a deep dive into that particular emotion. And what I found out was fascinating. You know, there's a lot of nuance to the emotion of awkwardness, to embarrassment, to cringe, and learning how to embrace it and befriend it is really a huge key to our success that we don't talk about enough.
It's so interesting, befriending it. Talk a little bit about social fitness. This is another concept from your work. What is social fitness and why is it important?
Yeah, I have a few different definitions for social fitness, but the easiest starting point is I want you to think of it as analogous to physical fitness. You know, we can be physically fit because we create strength, we do repetitions, we make choices intentionally. So social fitness is the social version of this. It's our ability to confidently, or at least without issue, navigate interpersonal dynamics, even when they're messy. And especially when they're messy, because human beings are messy. You know, we're not always predictable. It can depend on our mood. It can depend on the day. It can depend on our climate. And when it comes to building this social strength, it truly today is a huge competitive advantage when it comes to collaboration and influence, which is more crucial than ever as workplaces evolve. So like physical fitness, social skills are muscles. They are strengths that can actually improve over time if we put in the intention.
So give us an example of how social fitness helps us make better decisions.
Yeah, high social fitness. So again, high social muscle strength, as I like to refer to it in our research, it helps us see decisions through multiple lenses, which is really important. So if we're going to see things from other perspectives beside our own, typically, we need to involve other people or other perspectives. So this helps us break out of echo chambers. It helps us reduce our blind spots. When we can, you know, get some of the collected insights from other people, from team members, from clients, from keeping that social component top of mind when it comes to decision making, our decisions become clearer, they become smarter, and they become more human. And we know this is true because there are numerous studies about, you know, diversity in the workforce. I don't just mean, you know, physical diversity, color, gender, sexual orientation, but cognitive diversity, meaning when you have different types of thinking on a team or in a group, that the decisions, the outcomes tend to be better. So this is proven by research. When we can collect different perspectives, our decisions are clearer, smarter, and more human.
Yes, definitely. How about a common mistake people make when making decisions about their careers or their professional growth?
Yeah, this is personal for me, if I'm being honest. You know, chasing someone else's definition of success instead of honoring my own has probably been one of the biggest mistakes I've personally made when making decisions about my career. And I think the same could be said of most of my high achieving clients. Career decisions in particular require deep inner alignment, not just outer applause. And that's very difficult if you are someone who is, you know, kind of wired for people pleasing or approval seeking. To be able to honor that inner alignment over the outer applause takes work. It still takes work for me.
Absolutely. It's very difficult to sort of beat to your own drum. Mm-hmm. Right? And let's talk about business and life decisions that involve reevaluating our own progress, our potential. What's a common mental trap that holds people back from making confident decisions about their careers? And how would you suggest that somebody break through that?
Yeah, I often, when I'm working with my executive coaching clients, I refer to the rear view mirror syndrome, which is basing our future potential on our past wins or our past experience or on our past roles, titles, rather than future capability. So when we do that, we don't mean to, especially when we've had success. It actually can feel even harder. We let yesterday define tomorrow. We work really hard on preserving our existing wins or existing reputation rather than allowing ourselves to dream of what we're capable of. So we get a little bit stuck in what we have done and what we can do rather than, or I'm sorry, that what we have done and what we, you know, have found that we could do in the past versus what we actually can do even a week, a month, a year out into the future. So I think that particular, you know, honoring of letting ourselves look into the future and our capabilities of the future with a closer lens is really difficult, but really important when we're reevaluating that next step.
So how do you recommend that people do that? Since it's very visual, you can look back and see what you've done and the progress that you've had. How is it that you help them to break through and consider the future and make decisions differently?
Yeah, generally what people do is when they're looking at their past as a marker of what they're capable of, I think they tend to look at the activities themselves versus what the activity represented. So, okay, I am someone who is really good at writing, for example, and the next career step that I'm looking to take maybe involves more public speaking or more presentation. So that can be very scary, right? My rear view mirror says, well, that's what I'm really good at versus a future capability. If we look at it as writing versus public speaking, that can make you feel very trapped. It can be this versus that. Instead, what is it that is baked into the skill of writing? So maybe part of the reason that you're a talented writer is that you're really good at ideation, at coming up with ideas, of stringing concepts together, right? How can that actually feed this future capability? So it requires slowing down long enough to identify what are some of the shared traits of this person I was and this person I want to be. I think it becomes scary when we try to have a 180 flip of I was this and now I'm this. Rarely are we going from being a lawyer to, you know, a bar owner in the Caribbean. Usually people are making some pivots along the way. So where are their shared skills? Spend a little bit of time excavating those and it'll feel a little easier to make that change.
What a lovely description of how to be able to transform yourself, looking back to look forward. Obviously, and in the answer that you gave, there's a lot of focus that you must have on process, which is something that I also believe is very important. How do you think about process in terms of including stakeholders and other perspectives in your work?
This takes so much courage. It is so much easier to put our head down, do what we do best, focus on our own knowledge, our own process. So involving other people who will have their own opinion on what you do, how you do it, who you are, you know, that is something that requires a boatload of courage and a lot of humility. But the mental framing that is really helpful here is other stakeholders or other team members aren't obstacles, or they aren't always, right? Occasionally they can be, and you have to know, you have to have the discernment of whose advice do I want to listen to and take. But often stakeholders in particular are not obstacles. They can be huge clarity boosters. So again, what we talked about before, engaging diverse perspectives, it doesn't dilute your decisions. It actually makes them better. It makes them clearer. And if you take the advice or the guidance or the feedback from stakeholders who you admire and you want their opinions, it can actually turbocharge the effectiveness of the process and the decisions that you're making.
So to really make this something that our listeners can benefit from. Yeah. Can you apply that to a time where you made a difficult decision, how you did it and what you learned from it?
Okay. Well, twice. And it was the same situation both time, but the first one was more difficult. So I've made two career pivots in my life that were pretty significant. My first job out of college was Big Four public accounting, and I decided to leave that industry and go into executive search and staffing, which was a salary job with a prestigious international public accounting firm to a 100% commissions sales job. So that was very difficult. I'm, you know, again, immigrant parents, they loved the stability, the brand recognition of the previous firm. And I said, hey, I'm about to go work on commissions, doing sales for a firm that you've never heard of, right? So that was very difficult. I then did it a second time when I left my 14-year search and staffing career to pursue my current career as an entrepreneur, executive coach, keynote speaker, author. Scary again. In both cases, what I had to learn, and it was a very difficult thing to learn, but I had to learn is that my decision didn't need applause, but it needed to be authentic to me. So I had to get crystal clear on how can I get comfortable choosing alignment over approval? Because no matter how successful my next thing is, people are generally trying to protect me out of their own fear. And so, you know, kind of similar to what we just talked about, I wanted to break it down both for myself and in this case, you know, for the first pivot for my parents. They said, okay, well, what are their fears? Can we talk about them? Simone Biles doesn't jump onto the vault going, well, let's just see how I land, right? Shrug, you know, no, she's got a plan. She knows that if she, you know, turns a little too much, she knows how to adjust her body. You know, skydivers, they bring a parachute. So I don't suggest anyone makes a difficult decision recklessly. But there's always an understanding that A, applause is not going to be the thing that's going to help you feel good in your decision. You need to be internally aligned. And B, always build in a cushion, right? When you build in a cushion, you're going to know pretty confidently that even if you don't land on your feet, you're also not going to land on your face. So I think both of those things have been really helpful for me now in making decisions.
Thank you. How about assumptions and judgments? Obviously, you had a lot of perceived assumptions and judgments about being able to make this kind of pivot. How do you deal with that on your own? And how do you counsel the people who work with you to think about these cognitive biases and mental mistakes?
Mm-hmm. So we all have them. I playfully like to call them mindset monkey wrenches. I agree, I have names for everything. So when it comes to, again, natural assumptions and judgments. I want to underscore the word natural. Even the most self-aware of us are prone to falling into biases. It's a natural human thing. A couple things I suggest, but the main one is a two-parter of the same technique, which is I'm a big believer in tapping another. I sometimes refer to it as a bias buddy. So is there someone in your orbit who trusts you and you trust them who you can ask to challenge your thinking? Truthfully, if your ideas aren't regularly challenged, they're not fully formed. We need someone in our life that can regularly challenge our thinking. But here's the part two. I would love if you called a trusted voice because no one will ever do it better than another human. But in the absence of that, I sometimes call my friend ChatGPT. I will literally put a situation into ChatGPT and say, this is something I'm thinking about. I want to make sure that I'm not, you know, falling into assumptions and judgments of my own, or can you highlight for me assumptions and judgments others may have of this thing so I can be prepared for it? The technology these days, again, it's not going to be as fully formed as a friend who knows you well, but it certainly will give you a starting point of some things that you may consider that you may have not thought of before.
Absolutely. And just share for our audience, what do you unlock for your clients? What do they get better at?
So, you know, most of my job, I would say 80% of what I do is as a keynote speaker. So I have the good fortune of getting to do this with audiences, which, you know, in an hour, I want to unlock as much as I can without physically being able to touch every person. And so I would say what I unlock is clarity, courage, and specifically, it's, you know, helping people understand themselves better to the point where they can make better decisions. They can communicate powerfully in a way that is helpful to them. And most of all, embrace productive discomfort so they can become truly influential instead of agreeable. I spoke at South by Southwest this year, and there's a futurist named Amy Webb who refers to what I call productive discomfort or productive polarity. She was referring to it as the stone in your shoe syndrome. We all permanently have a stone in our shoe right now. The rate of change is so fast. And so what I hope to unlock is people's confidence in themselves to continue to work productively with the stone in their shoe. It's not going anywhere. It's here to stay.
What a nice thought. Heda, thank you for being with us today. Tell me, what am I missing? What haven't I asked? And please make sure that you share for our listeners how people can get in touch with you.
Oh, this was great. I had such a good time. You know, just a reminder to your listeners that awkwardness is not a deficiency. It's not a weakness. It's not a bug. It's a feature of modern changing times, of humans who are neurotypical and feel a way about all of the change. If we can learn to use it and harness it, it can be very powerful. And I am Henna Pryor in all the places, on LinkedIn, Instagram, at Henna Pryor, my website, hennapryor.com. But I've got an Inc. column, LinkedIn learning courses, would love, you know, like you, Cheryl, and would love to connect with your audience in any place.
Thank you so much. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us on this episode of the Problem Solved podcast.